Welcome to the Fat Endurance Podcast. Hey, Rob Jones.
Welcome.
Have you cleaned your legs yet? Oh, you didn't run this morning. You're wearing trousers.
No. I need to send you that photo. You are less skin, more blue from the track.
From the track, yeah. Not from the cold.
Because it rained.
It's been raining here in Dubai. No one knew that unless you don't have Instagram. There's a new weather app called Instagram. I don't know if you've seen it.
You open it up and people just post pictures of puddles or clouds or rain or flooding.
And you had flooding in your house.
Yeah, I only sent them to you though because we were comparing houses because we live in the same sort of house.
Yes, yeah, which are not waterproof.
They've built it like a child would build a Lego house and decided not to. They just set concrete slabs on top of each other and not waterproof them.
Yeah.
So at every join, it leaks.
But yours is coming through your roof skylight.
Roof skylight.
Did you close it though? I was it thinking to ask you this. Okay.
Yeah, but there's no cover on the top of the skylight. So it's like a 6 foot wide concrete rectangle that just fills the water.
That's why it's coming in.
That's why it's
Where's your
in.
Cover?
There isn't one. I don't know. I opened it up to see, got soaked and closed it.
I thought you've got enough tarpaulin. I've seen that coming out on camping trips.
I'm going to rig something up today now that it's sunny.
That's the best bit. You call maintenance and they're like, yeah, we'll come. Next time it rains, let us know. Like, yeah, once
Thanks.
A year.
Thanks, man.
Perfect.
Hit the dry season. Ready. It's going to be a sunshade instead.
Mate, you've got Jess on shortly to talk about Hyrox. I've already heard the interview. My particular favourite bit is when she came on the show and said that her one rule in Hyrox is she never stops moving.
Never stops moving, yep.
But turns out she did in this one.
Had a little lie down during the burpee.
I gotta be honest, I would be doing exactly the same thing.
And not only that, but it's not like the middle of her 80 meters of burpees. It was 1 meter before the end. She decided to pause for a few seconds. Unreal. She says it was a second. It was about three. We thought she'd not get back up.
Just given up.
Given up.
So that is coming up. And then we have an interview on today's show as well with Maddie Nutt. I want to say Maddie Nutty because she told me not to call her that. But that's Maddie Nutt, who is a professional gravel cyclist.
Mm.
Quite an interesting story. She's actually got a very cool story. She was in finance working in the big city of London and she realized this is not for me. And
not happy.
She went all in on cycling, particularly on gravel.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's a good show. Just more interested to hear how you went at Hyrox. I know you're doing a Hyrox segment, but is that it now? No more trail running? Ultra out? Hyrox in? Headbands on?
I've got my bag patch. It was good fun. They're very good at marketing and they're very good at wanting to suck you back into the next race. Jess will tell you all about it. They give you, if you like, your ranking order for each individual exercise so you can see if you're good at something or not very good at something, which then really urges you to want to go away, get better and improve at those areas that you're not good at and then try it again.
What was your best?
Running.
Yeah. Worst? Yeah.
Worst, sled push.
That surprised me.
Well, I didn't train a sled push before it.
Oh, you didn't know it was coming up?
Well, I knew, but...
All right, then. Yeah, that makes sense, then.
I figured I trained everything else, but because the way I asked people, can you stick enough weight on the sled at our gym and do it well? And like, you can't put enough weight on to push the sled because your feet will just slip on the concrete or the black mat. So I thought, oh, it's okay. I'll do without. I'll figure it out when I get there. And I did, and not very well.
And the day before 3 hour taper hike with Hannah on your back.
Yeah, a 25 kilo, 800 meter ascent.
Good training.
Hike in the blazing sunshine and spending 5 hours in the sun the day before. Suboptimal, but this is life, isn't it? This is why it is a fitness competition for everybody.
For everybody.
For everybody.
There was another fitness competition in Al Qudra that I thought you might come to, but you didn't.
I nearly did, but because I'd been so long away, I thought I'd best go home and see the family.
See the leaks.
You were mountain biking.
Yeah.
What was that? That looked great fun.
It was. Yeah, fun is a loose term with that.
It was not fun.
Yeah. It was so Al Salam is like the biggest bike championship here, cycling championship. They do a road race and they do a mountain bike race. Apparently it was the 8th year that
really?
It's been going on. Yeah, I didn't know that, but it had obviously been raining up in Al Qudra.
Puddles.
Without rain, that course would have been even worse because obviously it would have been a lot of soft sand.
Yeah.
But with some rain, it was a bit more hard packed. But
for
it's
the front guys.
Obviously so flat, right? So it was like a road race. And there's sections of the route. So it was 54 or 48K or 46, I can't remember. Sections of the route where you're on the cycle path. So you're not actually, so most of the route is through the desert.
Yeah.
But some of it you're actually on cycle path. To put into context how quick it was, I PB'd some segments on the cycle path, but on my mountain bike. And I've trained Al Qudra for 6 years on time trial bikes with disc wheels. It was so quick. It was like 2 hours of just on the limit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are sections as well where you had to jump off the bike and carry your bike up and over sand dunes.
Up sand dunes, yeah. I nearly protested about that. It was like being on a ride with Marcus.
I've got a good, there's a good video of him out there coming, cresting the hill with the bike on his shoulders, launching down and just jumping on. Actually, a good video of him as well, nearly coming off in the puddle.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. I was happy I got through both puddles without getting a foot down. Actually, no, the first one was definitely foot down. I forgot about that. I was like pure quicksand. And then the last one where everybody's at, it's like the final corner before you turn to head to the finish, is like a lot of pressure to not put your foot down. And you see in the video, I hit it and then I go to about 1 RPM. Everyone else is spinning through it. I was just absolute diesel engine through. But good fun, good experience. It does make me think they could, do you know what would be a great course for it? Is out near Jebel, Wadi Nacab climb, Jebel Yanis.
Ah, Jebel Yanis.
Then you could have a real cool finish because it's just uphill climb for 12K.
You could finish like that. There was another cycle race that finished like that, Jebel Hafit, where they did 20 or 30, maybe 40K around the bottom.
Yeah,
the
base 42K, of Jebel Hafit. I want to say, yeah.
And then the final 12K is up Jebel Hafit.
Yeah. Yeah. So some good. It's when you go looking for bike races here, you find them.
Are those races, they're not well advertised.
No, that's the thing I'd like to say. It'd be nice if it was all done, like you knew what was coming up 2-3 months before, but
yeah,
it's just not the way here.
And is there a series of them? Is there any more throughout the year?
I'd love to know, but we have a WhatsApp mountain bike group.
Pending.
And we get notifications about 1-2 weeks before, and then we know what we're doing. This race even changed date.
And actually, I had a look at their Instagram. I had a look at the stuff they put out. I couldn't figure out when it started.
No one else could. There was a big starting clock which counted down how long it was to go in minutes, and each time it would get to 10, they'd add another 10 back on. So you're like, we stood waiting for about, I think, 25 minutes for it to actually start.
Oh my goodness.
I think they just wanted it to rain a bit more and get darker.
Excellent. Yes. Right, we got lots on this show, so let's stop talking and jump in with Jess for her Hyrux roundup, and then you have Maddie Nutt talking about bicycling. Jess, welcome back. Are you going to say anything?
Oh, I was waiting for you to finish off saying something.
No, I was just going to say welcome back. The reason we've got you back on for the short segment, keep it short, is to round up. Actually, the podcast that we did on Hyrux was very well received, and people asked, could we have you back on to round up the event, how your race was, and especially now that they have just introduced another race in a new Middle Eastern city.
Exactly, 12 weeks as 12 well. Weeks. So it's a great 12-week training block from now till the next race.
There we go. So you can sell your coaching services Absolutely. For these events as well. How was it? Hyrux Dubai 2024.
It was awesome. It was double the size of the one we had in September. 6,000 people were there racing. I think it was very, very well organized, very well set out. And I thought it was a really good day. How did you feel?
Tired. I enjoyed the run. Some of the workouts I really liked. Some of the workouts I didn't like so much. But it felt that the whole thing went really quick. And like you say, the vibe on the day, the whole place was buzzing. It was full dopamine. It seemed like everybody from any CrossFit gym that I've ever known or met was there in some capacity, either supporting or competing, either in singles or doubles or relay. It was a very, very well-organized event.
Yeah, we spoke quite a lot last time about this mass participation and it being available to anyone. And I think that was so evident there on the day, like on that 500 meter loop of the run course, there was not one gap in the crowd. It was somebody from every gym that I've ever been in Dubai, you know, all different kinds of sports were there. The support was insane and it was so many different people. And that was evident from the crowds.
And on the support, actually, there was a good bunch of people from Innerfight there. And because the way these lay out this, well, the structure of the course, if you like, because it's 500 meter loops, you get to see people, you were saying, on four corners almost of every section of the run. So you were seeing supporters cheering your name at least 8 points on the run. And then people were following you around the workout stations as well.
I was never on my own in that race.
Are you aware of that when it's happening, or do you just block it all out?
I'm totally aware of it when I'm racing.
You are.
On the stations, I was aware that you were right next to me, but I was obviously focusing on what I was doing.
I had a camera in your face, that's
okay. But on the runs, I really look forward. Like, I'd come around the bends and I'd know that Rob's going to be on this straight.
Yeah.
And then I'd come around the next bend and know that somebody else from Innerfight was going to be on the next straight. And it was giving me, like, breaking the segments up in my head on the run course, knowing that I had that support going around. It helped me so much. And I was really, obviously, I was speaking to you quite a bit in the race.
Yes. not stopping having a conversation. We were shouting splits at you, yeah. How far ahead you were, how far behind the leader at one point you were, and how far ahead of third place you were, or second place in your, was she in your age group? No, she wasn't, was she? But how far ahead you were of the next person in your age group, I think ended up coming fifth overall.
Yeah. It was really helpful having you shouting at all my splits.
And then I think Andy was shouting at you some technique information whilst you were doing some of the exercises.
Yeah, I think at one point on the burpees, I just like laid on the floor and didn't get up.
Yeah.
And I just heard Andy and Rosa shouting, get off the floor, get up. Like,
talk us through your race then. So you, the top three in the pro women was very, very competitive. You went out very fast.
Yeah.
And there were seconds between you for the first 20, 30 minutes. It was neck and neck.
Like, I knew going into this race that it would be us three. I knew that us three were very close across all disciplines and the runs on time. And I knew that despite me saying in the last podcast that not to go off too fast, that everyone goes off too fast, I knew that we would.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that would set in. So I tried to relax it. I noticed I was on the front in the first run. Like, it was me that was leading.
You were.
So I tried to think, just stop, relax it a little bit. Like, you're in the lead. You're not chasing anyone. Like, try and hold it back a little bit. Set off slower than you feel. And then get into the ski. I knew that I would be first off the ski because that's one of my favorite stations.
Any idea of your first 1K run?
I think it was like 3:30, was it?
3:18.
Yeah, so it was a little bit fast.
A little bit fast. Second run, 4:08. And then it was very consistent after that. It was like sort of low fours, slowed towards the back half a little bit.
I think usually in high rocks, the slowest run is from between the lunges and the war balls.
Yeah.
That's usually the slowest one.
For that, you ran a 4:53.
Yeah. That's like the last run, and you your legs are tired from the lunges, and you do kind of hold back a little bit because you know you've got the 100 war balls to go.
Yeah.
So psychologically, you think I'm going to give myself a little bit for the war balls.
At that point, would you not think I need to just make an extra 10 seconds on the run here?
Yeah. So I've actually tried this in training, right, in simulations, and I did one a few weeks ago where I really hammered the last run, maybe saved 15 or 20 seconds, and then broke the war ball like 10 times. Whereas I've done it another one where I've relaxed a bit on that last run and done the war balls unbroken.
Yeah.
So it's just this game that you're always playing on what the tactics are best.
The overall winner of the race, Jade Skillen from the UK, she did exactly that as well. Her final run was 4:22, and all of her other runs were just under 4 minutes.
So slowed down a little bit.
Slowed down
by
20 seconds for that last run and got the war balls done in 3:49.
It's also exceptionally hard to run off doing all 100 meters of sandbag lunges.
I had cheeky legs for sure. Yeah. Starting to cramp up. I was like, oh, fuck, here we go. What then? So you just said, so top three, how does it work now? There's a world championships. I believe you actually, we've skimmed over this. You set yourself a world record for your age group.
Yes. So in the 35 to 39 age group, I posted the fastest ever time from a woman in that age group. So I currently have the world record.
And how ahead of the previous record was that?
About 30 seconds.
Oh, it's not bad. Will that be broken soon?
Hopefully not. I've got a few more years in this age group to keep getting more PBs, keep getting faster.
Where did you think, So training wise, from all of those stations, all of the workouts fits, where do you feel that you can make the most gain going forward into the next one?
I looked at what I did from the first HYROX to this HYROX. Mm-hmm. I tried to focus a bit more on my running because I thought that was an easy way to knock quite a few minutes off. If you can just get 10 to 15 seconds faster per K.
Yeah.
And so going into this one, where I got my 4 minutes this time was I was 50 seconds faster on the sled pull.
50?
50, yeah. So on the last HYROX, I kind of was a bit nervous about the sled pull and took it easy. Mm-hmm. And on this one, I was like, no, I don't need my arms for the run. I'm going to hammer my arms in the sled pull. I had a bit of a different tactic and I was 50 seconds faster. I was actually 28 seconds faster on the burpees this time.
Even with your little lie down? And
yeah,
relax.
Even with my lie down. And Andy telling me I was going too slow. I was 25 seconds faster on the war balls, which, to be honest, I had been working on them, so I'm happy with that. And I was 2 minutes faster on the run.
You had the fastest war ball time of the day.
Awesome. I'm glad about that.
You had the fastest lunges. You had the fastest farmer's carry. You had the fastest 1,000-meter row. The fastest ski erg. Second fastest sled push. Second fastest sled pull. Second fastest run total. And the third fastest burpees.
It's quite nice, isn't it, that you can, that HYROX break the race down like that and you can see exactly your splits for everything.
Yeah.
And where you came in your race in each segment. If you will.
I think that for the people that come back and want to do that race again, having that as a comparison tool sort of sucks you in and makes you want to come back and go, actually, well, I was 128th this time. Maybe I could get it to top 50 if I train this modality. And, you know, oh, my best run lap was 3:18, which was good enough for third. Maybe I could take 3 or 4 seconds off that and get first. You can almost look at what place you came in each of the stations and just maybe specifically focus on that for the next time.
And that's kind of exactly what I did from the last one to this one.
Mm-hmm.
And even on Sunday, when I got back to my phone, I had two of my clients text me already with their breakdown. They'd already looked at it and said, oh, I know I can get faster at this part and I know I can do better on the farmer's carry. And so within minutes of finishing the race, they were analysing and telling me what they want to work on for Doha.
There we go. So you just said there 12 weeks exactly until the next, let's call it local HYROX competition. For those that have done this one and are looking to improve in the next 12 weeks, what should they do? Where should they focus their energy? What would you do apart from get a coach like you?
Apart from having me as your coach? I'd work a little bit more on running.
Yeah.
I don't think people realise how such a huge part of HYROX the run is. It's a huge part. You spend most of the time running.
Yeah.
And then
definitely also, for the slower guys.
Yeah.
Even for us, it's about a 50-50 split, isn't it?
Yeah. And I don't know what you think about this, but running compromised is so different from just normal running. Like trying to run after you've just done those lunges or even the burpees. It's like nothing you've ever felt before. It's like doing an all-out effort at track and then having no rest and trying to repeat it again. With like, you've got lactic acid, you've got jelly legs. Yeah. I think like a lot of people underestimate how the run's going to feel after the station.
Yeah, see, because I suppose the pacing-wise, you're running at a half marathon paced effort. And if you, for a lot of people to hold that, they're running almost a 5K effort for 8K, which is why they can't sustain it.
It's like, yeah.
So definitely getting better at running. Where else? Where do most people lose their other time?
The war balls.
War balls. The last station.
Yeah, I think people underestimate the war balls because, oh, I've gone to the gym before and I can do war balls, right? But they're not thinking it's 100 reps after an hour and 15 minutes of really high intensity workout and get people crumble on the war balls. I've seen people that have been good at warbles, you know, in the gym normally take like 7 minutes to do 100 warbles. There's nothing left in the tank, and psychologically it's the last thing, and people don't think about that, and it's really tough, the warbles.
Did you go into the warbles with a game plan?
This time I did, yeah.
What was it?
Unbroken.
It didn't work.
It didn't work. So my game plan and what I'd been practicing was unbroken.
Yeah.
And I think I did 50 and then I broke.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's it, yeah.
And then I was
still
kicking,
posted the fastest time
as
of the day.
As soon as
that.
I put it down though, I was kicking myself. I was like, you can do it unbroken. You know you can. Pick it up. Like, yeah.
Oh, good. Will you be going to Doha?
Yes. Will you?
And this one's different. You said there's prize money at the Doha one, but there wasn't any for, or there's more prize money at Doha than there was for Dubai.
It hasn't been announced yet, but okay. I would say it, because it's HYROX Middle East, it would be the same.
Right, okay. And does that mean then, so from this, there was the leader in every single category got invited to the World Championships in June in France?
Yes.
Will that be the same? Will it just be the top one that goes through from Doha as well? Or will the, do you reckon we'll see a higher competition, or will we see a lower competition than Dubai?
So there will always be one slot available for each age group for the World Championships.
Yeah.
But like if someone's already claimed that spot.
Rolls down.
Yeah, it rolls down. So yeah. For my podium this time, it rolled down to like the third or fourth place because everyone else has already qualified in previous races. Okay. For the world champs.
So it's always worth going for it.
Yeah. And it's hard to say about the level. It's who's going to travel. Like we had athletes traveling from the UK, from Europe, from Australia. And it's just who's going to travel. Like, so we don't know what the competition's going to be like.
Watch this space. The good thing is as well, you can actually see who has signed up for the race. As soon as they sign up, it pops up on the website.
Does it?
Is there some tactics, do you reckon, in waiting to the last minute to sign up so no one knows you're coming? Although you've announced it on the podcast, so.
Yeah, I'm going to go. But I guess there is some. But the thing is, if you leave it too late, the prices rise. The entry fee, like, literally doubles if you leave it too late. So you need to get that early bird discount and
do it now.
Hear
that, folks. Get on board. Sign up soon to avail the discount. And then spend your spare money on getting Jess as your HYROX coach.
Exactly.
That's it. Good. Jess, thank you very much. We look forward to seeing you training for the next one. If you're interested in joining a HYROX training program or you're looking for some coaching towards your next HYROX event, email Jess, JT@innerfight.com. That's it. Thank you.
Maddie, welcome to the show. We've already run into some technical difficulties. You've saved us with your Zoom account. How are you?
I am very well, yeah. I am currently out in Girona, so better than I normally am. Because it's good weather. It's not too cold out here.
Yeah. We've just been chatting and we both agree Girona's the place to be.
Yeah.
When did you first end up going there, actually? How did you find it?
So I had some friends say it was a really good place to come and train. So I came on like a little training camp with two friends. I think it was just under 2 years ago. And then I ended up coming five or six times last year. So like I went quick from my first ever trip to coming about, I think it was about six times last year. And I've been already
favorite
in the past few, like past 2 months.
Of course. Favorite cafe spot?
Oh, that changes. So at the moment it's Tramontana, but it used to be an area. But Tramontana is quite new. But the reason I prefer that is because it's open until like 8 or 9. I think it's 8. And so you go for like a chai latte in the afternoon, evening. Whereas like the other ones are just during the like morning or day.
Yeah. The ones that serve beer, they sit at the top of my list.
Yeah.
You're originally from London, though, and how did you? You were from London, and from what I can see, you used to be in finance. Tell us a bit about that. So your YouTube says city finance to gravel and travel.
Yeah, so I quit my job. You say I resigned from my job 2.5 years ago. So I actually, to be fair, I was only in the city for about 6 months. I finished uni. And then went straight into like a finance job at like one of the big investment banks. Basically, my role involved like trading, but also kind of financial advice, passed all my exams, was working ridiculous hours. So I had to be at my desk at 7 a.m. and I couldn't leave until 7 p.m. minimum, Monday to Friday. And I just found that like my life, quality of life was significantly reduced when I couldn't train. And it was quite hard to train. So I was just commuting in. So I'd wake up at 5:30, hop on my bike, ride to the office, ride back from work. And I was absolutely knackered. I'd try and ride as much volume as I could on the weekend. I tried to still race on the weekend. And I just found that I wasn't particularly happy because I wasn't able to ride my bike as much. So yeah, I was doing that and then took a bit of a punt with cycling and gravel cycling and decided to resign on the principle that I could train more and start racing again and just kind of, yeah, enjoy what I was doing. And in that first year, I'd say, I mean, initially when I resigned from my job, I wasn't very good. And it was a bit of a gamble because I didn't necessarily have like the results to kind of back up that decision. I wasn't someone who was like outstandingly good and had like a fair reason to stop their job. Probably would have made more financial sense also to stick at the job. But I took the risk and started training. And then, yeah, did like a full race season in the UK mostly, a couple of gravel races abroad, just giving it a go. And then last year was kind of my first full season as like a gravel privateer, just racing internationally. And then, yeah, I'm kind of onto my second season now. I'd say it's my third season of like taking cycling pretty seriously, but my second season as like a gravel racer.
Amazing. And how old are you now?
I'm 25. So I kind of entered the workplace a bit late anyways, because I took some time out and like changed uni. But I think now I might not enter the workplace properly again.
So, wow. So yeah, go back 2 years, you're in the city working. Fast forward 2 years, you're now sat doing what you absolutely love to do, which is racing professionally for a gravel team on the gravel professional circuit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've like taken a big leap.
Take us back a bit though. How did you first get into cycling? Where did it all begin?
So I cycled a bit as a kid. So I used to cycle to school every day when I was younger. I actually had a unicycle and I unicycled to school for a few years.
No way.
Yeah, it's one of those things that like most people don't know about me and it's embarrassing, but I can ride a unicycle. I don't have one anymore, but I did that. And then I didn't have a bike from about the age of 11 to 20. So I got a bike when I was 20. I was having a bit of a kind of, I'm going to say, quarter life crises, needed to find some like outlet and inspiration and something to kind of keep me going. My mental health wasn't that great. So I got, I like signed up to my old triathlon club, got on a bike eventually, signed up to a half Ironman as like a challenge. And honestly, getting around that was hard work. I'd only ridden that distance on a bike before, once before the half Ironman with six cafe stops. So 90K for me at that point was a real tough ask, but I got around and then just started riding more. And as I started riding more, I realized I loved it compared to the running and swimming, eventually quit the running and swimming. And yeah, took the cycling more seriously. I dabbled in a bit of triathlon and duathlon, but slowly kind of realized that I just wanted to spend my time riding a bike.
Amazing. So what you have quite a big why behind why you're doing what you're doing, and cycling kind of pulled you out of a sort of darker place, if you like, and it's even pulled you away from the sort of 9-to-5 work life or 7-to-7 work life that you were in. So you must really, you know, have a lot of every day you're thinking you're just so happy to be doing what you're doing.
Yeah, I definitely have moments. I actually noticed the other day, I was like out on the bike riding here, training on my own in Girona the other day, doing like a really hard session. And I got into like the bit afterwards where I was just riding zone 2. And I was just like, oh my, I cannot believe that this is like a weekday and how I'm spending my time now. That like the contrast between me sitting at a desk really struggling to like get through the day, like every day was a struggle to get to the end of the day, because 12 hours for me sat down in one position, just mentally concentrating, was very, very difficult. And yeah, just thinking that now I'm outside in the sunshine training, which I love doing, and I absolutely love training. Yeah, it's pretty mad that that's kind of like now reality.
And you must have quite, I want to use the word resilience, but I'm not sure that's the right word for this, but to go to school on a unicycle, you can't care too much what other people are thinking. You must just be like, this is fun, I'm going to do it. And then to use cycling, to get back into cycling again and do the triathlon like you did, again, you're just thinking, this is fun, this is what I want to be doing, right? And then you sat in an office, you must have been thinking, it must have been a real crazy change for you, for someone with your kind of mindset.
Yeah, I think so. I think the office period of my life was, I felt like that was the natural thing for me to do because I was quite academic. And then after my degree, I was like, oh, I might as well apply for those jobs. And it's just what everyone around me was doing. So I was thinking less about myself and like what I enjoy and what sort of personality I am. And just more like, this is what adulting is. Like adulting is like getting a good city job, earning money, like losing all those elements around it. But I think I kind of had this like wake up call when I was basically making myself sick by doing that job. Like I was ill every weekend from training. I would literally go to work on a Monday with a disgusting cold almost every week. And also mentally, I just really couldn't hack it. I really, really struggled to like get through working days without moving.
It's so funny you're saying adulting, just conforming into adult. I don't know how many, we've probably got quite a lot of listeners listening, just thinking, wow, they've probably been at a stage in that in their life as well, but kind of stuck it out. But for you at the age of 25 to recognize it and go and chase what you absolutely want to be doing is huge, actually. It's, yeah, kudos to you.
I think
I couldn't do an office job either, by the way. I'd struggle a lot.
I think like it's about quality of life in a way. Like I also think for me, I realized that my priority isn't earning a lot of money so that I can live really well when I'm older. I'd much prefer to just earn enough to live and to live a really enjoyable, exciting life from now. Like why would I wait until I'm 40 to retire early because I've had a good city job to then spend the money on nice bikes that I won't be able to ride very fast when I could work hard training now and get nice bikes that I can ride fast because I'm good rather than because I've like earned enough money to splash the cash on a really fancy bike.
So good. Who taught you that? How have you got this mindset?
This is a good question. I actually don't know where it's come from because it's not like, yeah, necessary. I think I never had pressure from my parents to pursue a very serious job. That was kind of just myself. I've kind of picked up from a few friends, I think. But yeah, it's an interesting, I'm not really sure where it came from because most people who I went to university with don't live like that. And it's kind of only friends that I've made since who also have similar mindsets, who I've met through cycling. But yeah, I'm not really sure where it came from, to be completely honest.
Did you get any pushback when you decided to do it?
No, I would say I don't think I got any pushback from anyone. I actually, interestingly, like when I left the job, almost everyone I used to work with, because I got on really well with my colleagues, almost all of them organized a meeting with me to say goodbye. And almost every single one in that meeting said, I would prefer to be pursuing X or Y. And it was all loads of different things that they were passionate about. And they were like, I wish I had the confidence and the boldness that you have to just make that move and pursue your passion. And I was just like, why not? Like, I think people are, it's almost like people are too scared to kind of take a risk, especially if it's financial when you're younger. But yeah, I don't know. I decided that it was, I didn't care enough about money to pursue a job that I didn't enjoy.
Amazing. So that's probably why you chose the gravel scene, the risk element, the fun, the adventure. Road cycling's got its risks, but it's a little bit more sort of, you know, you can predict it a little bit more. Whereas the gravel scene is, I mean, even a change in weather can change the course completely to what you think you're going to get, right? Did you do a lot of road cycling getting into it, or did you know like I'm going to do gravel and that's what I want to focus on?
So I kind of started doing both. I did a bit of like crit racing, a bit of road racing, and in all honesty, it's part of it is the enjoyment of the events. I prefer the atmosphere of gravel events. I prefer the gravel scene. I find road racing a little bit more stressful, less fun. But the other element of it is also just on like my physiology and how I race best. And I honestly just can't get a result in a road race. Like regardless of how like fit I get or like how strong my threshold is, as soon as I get into a road race and someone surges, I'm suffering. Whereas in a gravel race, you're pushing a certain intensity all day. And most people don't have that endurance and can't like hold that amount of power all day over like difficult terrain. Whereas I quite like just riding pretty damn hard for hours. That's what suits me better. So I think it's partly that. It's my physiology and where like my strengths lie, as well as it being like a much nicer scene personally. Like I know some people love road racing, but I quite like the gravel scene and the people in gravel in comparison to like the road scene.
So tell us a bit about the scene then. What does it look like? Well, how is it different? I mean, I can imagine some of the ways already, but sort of from the inside, how does the gravel scene with the people and yeah, what you're talking about there, how does that differ to the road?
So I think a main thing is like the volume of privateers versus teams. So like on the road, you only have teams, to be honest. Like there's very rarely a situation where someone's like a privateer. And if they were, it would only be like racing domestically, like they wouldn't be racing internationally. So it's the privateer element where people are either in collective. So like I'm in the Ribble Collective, which is like a collective of privateers where we're all sponsored by Ribble. So we're all on the same bikes. There we've got the freedom of having our own other sponsors, building our own other relationships, but also having some sort of like teammates at certain races. But I think the element where there are a lot of people who are sole privateers means that you go to a race and you hang out with loads of different people who aren't your teammates, but you all have like this kind of nice connection with each other. Whereas road racing is very like you stick with your team. Like it's a little bit more competitive in that sense. Whereas I can like build relationships with people in gravel who I race, and I have friendships and relationships that make going to races such a nice experience. Yes, we're still going to race each other and be competitive as soon as like the start gun goes, but around the race, it's actually like way more of like a community spirit than I'd say road racing is.
You less daggers in the peloton.
Yeah, there's definitely less. There is still competitiveness, and obviously not everyone is friends because that's life. But on the whole, I think there's like we basically build better connections, and you've just got complete flexibility to do exactly what you want to do as well. Like I can, if I'm thinking about doing a race in a random country that I'm interested in going to, I'll pitch it to sponsors. And I've yet to have a race where people said, no, don't do that. So I've literally just chosen races where like, which I want to do, which is not something you'd get if you were on like a professional road team. It would be very much dictated to you where you were racing.
Yeah. And a lot more training camps that you're held to. And I'd imagine quite a bit more performance in your training numbers and things as well, if you're in a road team.
Yeah, I reckon so. I think you'd have more pressure on you in terms of performance. Whereas in gravel, like there still is, you could put personal pressure on performance, but I would say like I don't really feel pressure from my sponsors in terms of performance, which is quite a nice position to be in. I obviously like personally want to do well and get certain results, but I don't feel like I'm under any performance pressure, and I have like no element of my contract that's like these are performance targets that you need to hit.
Yeah, that's nice. I mean, that's really breeding pure freedom in riding, which someone like you is what's going to get the best out of you, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. I think I'm riding faster and better when I'm happier. So definitely like...
I think that's the same for most. So your YouTube channel, actually, you have a YouTube channel and it's called Maddie Nutt, but Gravel and Travel, which
yeah.
play. Tell us about the travel. Is that another element? And you just discussed it then with why you chose gravel around the traveling. But have you always enjoyed traveling, or was it something that you wanted to do more of? And that's why you kind of went into that sport and merged them up.
So I've always enjoyed traveling. I've like been someone who's any opportunity I can really to go to a new place I've gone to. I used to love traveling before I got into cycling, and it was definitely easier to do before I got into cycling. And now traveling is obviously always with a bike box. I think I've been on 2 trips in the past year that didn't have my bike with me. And I have to say, it's quite sad to not travel with a bike and be somewhere where you, even if, especially if it's like a stunning place and you want to be able to go for a ride and properly explore, and I don't have my gravel bike with me. But yeah, no, I have always enjoyed traveling, but I think that is the thing that I find like really unique and amazing about gravel is just the locations it takes you to. So like last year alone, I went to Iceland, Kenya, America. Like at one point I went to 3 different continents in 3 weeks, which was a little bit silly from like a fatigue recovery perspective and jet lag, but the just like the opportunities and like seeing the world and like where you go within those countries as well. So for example, like Kenya, I was riding through the Masai Mara National Park, whereas if you were doing a road race, even if you were doing a road race in like that part of the world, you would be more based in like a city in a hotel and you wouldn't really get the freedom to kind of travel around outside of the racing. So yeah, that's definitely something I've picked up on about gravel and then kind of optimized on it myself with like extending my trips either side or on one side of the race. I've started to do that quite a bit just so I can like properly experience where I'm going.
Yeah. And the gravel, whenever anyone says gravel to me, I think of you're camping, you've got a bike full of bags on, you've definitely got a bar bag on, you've got bivy sat ready to go. Is that also the case in your races? Are you camping rough? Are you sleeping out under the stars type of stuff? Or do you, is because you're doing it as a professional, are you a bit more looked after or have you got more comfort?
So race dependent, I would say the Migration Gravel Race, which was one I did in Kenya this year, that was literally like camping, like that was that extreme end. We didn't carry any of the stuff with us, so like the race transported our stuff between each stage, so that element we were looked after and they sorted food for us. But that was definitely on that more extreme end. The sort of races I've been doing, I mean, I kind of stick to single day stuff, although I will be doing an ultra race this year, this summer, but on the whole I stick to single day things. So with that, it actually, at the racy end, you've got people wearing skin suits. I mean, I'm not going to be wearing a skin suit this year. I definitely did last year in some races. But yeah, you've got people with aero helmets, wearing skin suits, like cutting weight on their bike left, right and center. Gravel can get like aero socks. It can get a little bit racy.
That surprises me actually. But yeah, it makes sense. If you want to win and it's how you make your living, you want to get every advantage, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, people get in wind tunnels on their gravel bike.
Yeah, I've not seen Lachlan Morton in a wind tunnel yet, but could be coming. Is there a set circuit you guys are racing? Do you know what race you're going to at what time in the year? I know you said you've picked a few, but is there a general, if you want to sort of be as successful as you can within the sport, which I assume means obviously making a better living from it, do you have to do certain races and it ends up at a world champs, or is there a series? How does that work?
So there's a couple of different things. And I think in a way gravel is a little bit saturated at the moment with there's too many things you could do rather than it being like one key series or something where everyone's targeting the same series. And then it's quite hard as an athlete to work out which races are the ones for me to go to where other people will be at. So like the level of competition is a certain level. So the main ones are, so in Europe, and actually it is international now, it's global now, the Gravel Earth series is the main series that I kind of personally focus on. So I came 3rd overall in that last year, which was the first year of the series. And that has races like all over the world. So I'm going to be doing the race in Kenya again, Iceland, there's a big one in Spain called the Tracker. So that's a big series. And then there's a series in America called the Lifetime Grand Prix, which is gravel and mountain biking. And I am not doing that. So that's quite exclusive. You have to like apply to get in, and it's half mountain bike racing, half gravel racing. And I don't have a mountain bike, nor do I ride mountain bike. So that was kind of off the cards for me for now. Definitely something I wouldn't say no to at some point in the future, but I need a little bit of time to get the mountain bike skills. And then there's also the UCI World Series. So the UCI from 2 years ago, so 2022 was the first year they did this. There was like this gravel World Series, basically, with races around the world. And those qualify you for the world championships, but also you can have a wild card selection from your national federation, which is how I've kind of done the last 2 world championships. But I don't tend to focus on the UCI races because they don't really suit me. They're a lot more road racy. Typically, they completely vary depending on the race. I'm going to do 2 this year, but Last year I did a few more, and I just find that they're a bit more like bunch road racy, less technical, shorter, and therefore they're better for roadies who are dipping their toes into gravel rather than like someone who's committing to gravel. So yeah, I prefer the more like closer to a whole day out, much harder, more technical, those sorts of races.
Some just pure adventure of the place around you and yourself as well.
Yeah, exactly. Like I actually quite like a race where I'm like really pushing myself to my limit. Like I like to finish a race and be pretty empty, whereas the UCI stuff can just be like 3-4 hours, and that's not as appealing.
Yeah. You're obviously doing this now full time. It's your job. How do you structure, let's start with the year, but I'm interested how you break it down from, you know, year to what races you're going to select to, you know, what sort of training cycle you're in. Are you working with a coach? And then down to even like your weeks and your days, how are you, because you've not got a boss, I guess you are your own boss. So what drives the structure from big to small?
It's a good question. I would say there is structure, but it's quite fluid. So I'm basically working week by week basis, what I've got on that week and like what my next target is. So off season, I took in November, end of October, November after Worlds, just took a break, went on holiday, kind of like didn't think about the bike for a few weeks. Then it was kind of straight onto, and I already had to do this as a privateer. You're kind of like in charge of those relationships with sponsors and sorting out any potential new relationships. So I was having all of those conversations and all of that like legwork was going on kind of alongside World Champs. And then after World Champs, tried not to think about it too much in my off season, but it's quite difficult if you want to be signing contracts for the next year. And then kind of straight into like training really off the back of that. I went out to Mauritius in Australia because I wanted to get some like sun, and there was a race out in Australia. So I did that this winter, but that kind of changed what I would normally be doing, because I would normally just be doing like a big training block, but instead I went and did a race, but as part of a training block. And then, yeah, it's just kind of race by race. I don't try and, so I work with a coach, and kind of my thing's been, because I'm racing so much, I don't try and like specifically taper and peak for racing. I just kind of keep racing and keeping to as high a level of fitness really as I can. I obviously choose a couple of races that I want to really target and focus on and peak in a way, but I don't have like training cycles in the way like a triathlete would have, for example, where they really kind of peak for one event, then take time off and then peak for the next event. I kind of keep a real steady volume, high volume of training and racing throughout until October, basically. So I've got a race next week in Girona, and then my last race will probably be in October. So it's not a short season.
Not at all. And how are you looking after yourself during the season then? Because you actually, it's not about you not training enough, because you love what you do. It's probably you going into an overtrained state. How do you manage yourself there? I saw you were actually wearing a Whoop just now, and you obviously you're working with a coach, but what else are you paying attention to within yourself?
So I care quite a bit about my nutrition. I think I'm pretty on top of that just personally, and then sleep. And that's why I've got a Whoop. So I got a Whoop so that I could like get really on top of like how much I'm sleeping and recovering. But I think a lot of it is to do with like trust with your coach. And I kind of trust my coach, I've worked with him for just under a year. And since working together, I've only got stronger as an athlete and feel I'm like way healthier as well. And I think he's really good at knowing when like I need to push harder or when I need to kind of hold back and recover. I have a tendency to overtrain. I'm sure a lot of athletes do, but I've kind of learned now that I get the most out of myself and the highest quality out of training sessions if I properly recover in between them. I used to have like, this is a terrible habit, but when I was kind of self-coached, or yeah, a few years ago, I would, on my recovery day, I'd go for like a 3-hour walk, because I was like, it's my recovery day, I can go for a long walk, I'm not riding my bike. And it would be about 3 hours. And yeah, it took me a bit of time to go, that's just not a recovery day. Like I can actually classify a walk as exercise.
Yeah, definitely not recovery 3 hour walk. And you're, I guess, as well, you're around people who are also riding a lot. And, you know, there's nothing nicer than a coffee ride or a ride out to a nice coffee shop. But again, that's not a recovery day. But sometimes you're just caught up in the cycle of, especially if you've not got other things going on in your day, it's easy to just get out on the bike and go. From a, obviously within a team, as we chatted about, from a road cycling perspective, you're kind of given more structure and set days, if you like, of training and not training, or what days you're doing. But how do you, with your coach, how do you decide, because you like being around other people as well, are you kind of getting other people on your program, or do you find yourself drifting onto other people's programs, or are you trying to get everyone all on the same program? What do you like to do?
This is actually a really interesting question. So I'm quite strict at, like, I pretty much stick to my program. And I'm lucky in the sense that when I'm in London, most of my friends that I ride with aren't racing. They're like a lot of guys who just ride for fun. So they're quite willing to hop onto my session. So if I'm riding in London, a lot of the time it's easy to get someone, or I line up and talk to a friend and say, when's yours, like, zone two ride? Let's try and line up. Every so often I'll try and switch rides around, and I feel sorry for my coach when I do this, because I'm like, oh, there's a social ride going out tomorrow with, like, a whole group of my friends. Is it okay if I do my endurance ride then? And I do that. And he's quite good at switching stuff around for me. But yeah, it is. I think it depends on you as an athlete. I think I do care about doing the training properly. So I will always prioritize doing my training when I need to do it, and I'm happy to train on my own, but I like work it around social stuff. So, like, I will do my efforts and then go join a social ride or something like that if I wanted to. Or just, I'm always open with people. I hate when you go on a social ride and someone has efforts and they've not told the group ride that they had efforts to do, and then they just randomly start doing efforts in a social ride. I'd never do that. So I would always, like, say, this is what I'm supposed to do, and try and work it out and, like, work around people. But yeah, it is hard when everyone has conflicting coaches and no one's on an identical plan. So it can be really, really hard to line up.
Yeah. And if you were back 2 years ago, or let's say someone is doing what you were doing 2 years ago, they're working Monday to Friday, office job. And then on the weekend, they're trying to sort of become a breakthrough cyclist, if you like. Knowing what you were doing and knowing what you know now, what sort of advice would you give that person who's riding, trying to be competitive, but within their job, and they can't do what you did, which is just pack it in and go full time?
That's a good question. I think, so if I was able to work from home, which I wasn't, but if I had have been able, and I think most jobs now have that flexibility, I think you can get really, really good quality training out of, like, training on Zwift, like training on a turbo, and kind of working that into your workday. It depends on the job. I think my job was extreme in the sense that I wasn't allowed to, like, go to the gym in the middle of the day. And therefore, like, the only riding I could do was before and after work, which would have been like 5 a.m., 8 p.m. And you can't really ride then. I would say it's like quality actually can be more important. So putting in a few sessions when you can do them, and like making sure they're really high quality. And then on the weekend, not just killing yourself and riding all weekend because you want to ride your bike, because that just leads to like burnout essentially. And burnout is not a nice place to be.
I'm glad you said that. That would be what I was preaching as well. Yeah, it's hard though, right? It's like you've been in it. You absolutely love riding your bike, and the whole week you're sat in your office. So on a weekend, of course, all you want to do is be out and riding your bike. And it's very hard to hear that when you're in that position.
Yeah, 100%. I also think it's the health thing. As soon as you're overtraining, when you're mentally fatigued, you're literally hampering your immune system, and your susceptibility to any kind of illness is just super high. And then when you're ill, you can't work, you can't train, you're like, you're just taking weeks back. I actually got really ill back in December, and it was definitely COVID, and I couldn't have really done anything to avoid it. But that took me back. I would say it's taken me until now to get back to the level of fitness I was at before that. Getting ill is probably one of the worst things that can happen as a cyclist, and putting yourself at higher risk of that by overtraining on a weekend is just absolutely not worth it.
Yeah, agreed. You're currently in Girona, which is, I wouldn't say it's up and coming. It's probably up now and has been up and coming the last few years, the last decade or so. Certainly within the gravel scene, and I know there's a pretty good mountain bike trails there as well alongside the road scene. But gravel has had a huge boost over the last probably 5 years, I would say, with a lot of people, but probably the most notable, like Lachlan Morton, who left the pro peloton to pursue his almost, well, bikepacking / gravel dreams. Are you seeing more people coming into the sport and or switching over to the sport, or are people who are doing gravel sort of similar crowd who were doing it 5 years ago?
I would say it's a completely new crowd. So there's barely anyone who have kind of been there for a long time. I actually have had multiple people refer to me as an original gravel racer, and I've only been doing it for 2 years. So considering that little time that I've been in it and that I'm kind of considered an original, it shows kind of how new it is and how it's being flooded with different riders. I think people are realizing that it's more fun than road racing. I mean, I'm obviously being quite biased here, but I think people on the road are seeing opportunities in gravel. And similarly, there's some mountain bikers who have hopped over this year. I think people are seeing opportunities there. In terms of the bike industry, it's obviously one of the largest growing sectors of the bike industry in terms of just sales, gravel bike sales of on the up versus other kind of bikes. And yeah, I think that's where the money is in some aspects. I say that and then I'm it's actually quite hard to get sponsorship. So not necessarily where all the money is, but there definitely is money there. And I think people are noticing that and then heading more in that direction. But also I think a lot of it's on the fun side of things. I think people think, I mean, we are having a great time over in gravel, but I think there's definitely there's definitely a view, and sometimes I think this is an unfair view of if you fail on the road, you can go over to gravel. There's gravel's kind of the way to make it or kind of make your way in cycling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's similar in triathlon with Xterra. If you don't do well on the road, you go and buy a mountain bike and go and race off road, which I have done. But it's like you say, it's more fun. It's actually way more fun to do it that way. And something that surprised me when last year I raced Xterra for the first time, and actually noticed that the women to men split was actually amazing compared to doing road triathlon. Is that the same you find in gravel as well? The men to women split is a bit more closer than you would see in road cycling?
I think it's improving. Definitely when I first started, there weren't many women racing gravel. It's definitely improving. You can definitely see that also the depth of the women's field is really improving. So I would say there's still a lot more men on the start line, but say the top 20, top 30 women and top 20 and 30 men are all of a very similar level within their gender. So unlike how it used to be, where maybe there was a couple of really strong women and then there were just people having a good time, there now really is depth in the women's field. And I definitely noticed that in the race I did in Australia, Raddle Gravel, the women's field was definitely stronger. Although there was a reason for that. The Tour Down Under, the men's race was on at the same time as Raddle Gravel, whereas the women's race was the week before. So the women could do the World Tour race and the gravel race, whereas the men could only do one or the other. So the women's field was a lot stronger. But yeah, on the whole, I think the depth is there now. There still is, it's cycling. There is going to be a huge gender disparity in terms of numbers. But you start to see with there are races who say 50-50 on the entries. So I think there's a race I do in Wales, Battle on the Beach, where literally 50 participants, 50% male, 50% female. And they do that because they're oversubscribed. So it's easy for them to do that.
Yeah. And prize money wise, it's the same as well.
Prize money, there isn't really prize money in gravel most of the time. And this is something that I think surprises people. But this year, so there's prize money in the Lifetime Grand Prix in America, and that is 50-50. And this year, there's prize money in the Gravel Earth Series, which again is 50-50. So I think when there is prize money, it is equal. But on the whole, I mean, last year, I think I made like 250 quid. I like added it up at the end, and I was like, wow. I really haven't made any money this year off prize money. And I had a good season. So it's just a lot of these races don't have prize money when I think they maybe should, because there's a lot of eyes on them and there's a lot of professional athletes taking part, sponsors like are keen and watching them. But yeah, just a lot of the time there's race organisers aren't dishing out any money.
So, and this isn't a blunt question from me. I've seen it on your YouTube channel, but how are you making money then as a professional gravel racer? It's purely sponsorship.
Well, last year I made a loss, which you would have seen on my YouTube video. this year
I just saw the thumbnail. I didn't actually go into it. I thought I'd save it for this.
If I made a loss. So last year my expenses were larger than what I brought in from racing, which I sort of expected because I committed to quite a lot of like big trips that were expensive and I knew that they would be above my budget, but I thought that they were worth the investment in terms of then kind of raising my profile as an athlete, like having those opportunities and then maybe bringing in more sponsorship the next year. This year, I hopefully will not be making a loss, but I'm not making enough to like fully support myself on cycling. So I fill the gap a little bit with a bit of part-time tutoring. So when I'm traveling, I'll hop on a Zoom call and help an A-level math student study for their exam. So I do that from like October, September until June, and then take a break when they take their summer holiday and race. But yeah, that's how I kind of manage it. But I set up the YouTube channel as a potential other stream of income, and I'm kind of looking into other streams now. But kind of off the results last year, I've managed to kind of renegotiate with my current sponsors and improve some of those deals, and take on some new sponsors as well. So hopefully I will make it more sustainable. My kind of goal is just to make it sustainable so I can keep kind of living this lifestyle because I love it and it's how I want to be spending my time. But I might have to reflect on that in a few years and see if it's realistic. But yeah, for now, my savings account has been slightly diminished. I would say it was 100% worth it.
That's all right at 25. You mentioned YouTube, and it feels like every professional athlete has to come with a YouTube channel now. Do you feel like you had to do it, or is it something that you wanted to be doing as part of your brand? And if so, how do you organize that as well? You surely don't want to be filming every ride.
Yeah, that's a really fair question. I think I don't think YouTube has to come with being a professional athlete, but I think some form of social media, unless you are the best of the best. And even then, I would say you need some sort of presence on social media, whether someone else is controlling it for you. Social media is important because it's all about connecting with your fans and your audience. I say fans, but like the audience, the people who are supporting you around the world to like do the racing you're doing, because at the end of the day, they're the ones who your sponsors are interested in, because they're the ones who are going to potentially buy products off your sponsors based off your performances or your personality. So I think it is important to have some sort of presence on some form of social media. I personally do YouTube, and I've got like an Instagram profile as well. I haven't delved into the TikTok because I'm not really a TikTok person, but I think for me, the YouTube is... Yeah, I think I'm a bit old for TikTok, but YouTube kind of suits my personality. I made a couple of videos just to give it a go. I it wasn't an obligation from any sponsor. It was, I said, why don't I make a YouTube video and see what it's like? I also really wanted to just record that moment in this race I do, Battle on the Beach, where there's 10,000 people. Is it 10,000 or 1,000? It might be 1,000 people running down a beach.
10,000 people can't fit in Wales.
No, I don't think nothing to fit in Wales. Like all running down a beach and then like diving onto their bikes at once. And I was like, I really want to capture that from my bike. So that was why I did the first video. And yeah, I actually enjoyed it. And I got really positive feedback from people about kind of yeah, the style I was doing for the videos, and just kind of kept going, got momentum off the back of that. And yeah, like, I enjoy it. If I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't do it. But I definitely don't video every ride. I mean, I've recorded most races I've done since I started doing it, but I've not recorded every race. I will not take a GoPro out on like a group ride with friends. I think I've done it once. And I think I've got quite good boundaries with it. I've seen influencers out in the wild. I say influencers. I've seen people out in the wild who are like on YouTube and like sticking GoPros in people's faces without permission and things like that. And I'm just not about that. Like, I'm never going to like stick a camera in someone's face and force them to chat to camera. I'm a bit too, not, I'm not shy, but I'm a bit more like reserved than maybe other people are in that sense. But yeah,
probably respectful would be the word.
Respectful of other people's want or not want to be on my YouTube channel. But yeah, like I think it's important to have a balance. Like, I know I do know that I need to be producing content and that it's something that I need to be quite consistent with. But equally, like, I went to South Africa in my off season and I barely went on social media. Like, I didn't go on social media. I didn't make a vlog. It was an amazing trip. I didn't make a vlog of it. Didn't need to. And I think it's important to have those boundaries because, like, I have relationships with like family, friends, like I've got a partner, and I don't need that to be all over the internet all of my life.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Good on you. You're 25 going on 45. I think the wiseness you have.
It's because I started getting gray hairs when I was 21. I think that's where it comes from.
No.
I did. I started going gray when I was 21. And I'm 4 years in. I'm at a point where I'm like, either I need to dye my hair or I just embrace it. And I think I'm just going to embrace it and have like gray streaks all over my hair.
Yeah. Why not? Goes with the gravel scene. I need to hook you up with one of our guys we've had on the show a couple of times, Josh Stinton. He did a unicycle mountain bike race. I can't remember where it was. It's like Japan or something. Anyway, that would be right up your street. Unicycle, off-road tires.
I do not have the skills for that. I can ride a unicycle, but I used to have to, when I went to school every day, my sister, so we both unicycled to school every day. She can get on without a wall. I would have to go over to a wall if ever I fell off. So I can't get on without a wall. So there's nowhere I'd be able to do a descent on a mountain, like a mountain bike unicycle.
You have to train for it. It would help YouTube for sure.
Yeah, that would be some.
Maddie, you've said some really incredible things through the show in terms of how you made the change into doing what you love. And even then what you're talking about with boundaries around social media and stuff. It's so important for everybody to be hearing it. But let's say people are interested in trying out the gravel scene. They have 30 days of holiday in their year. They can only do one gravel race, one trip. We don't need to talk about bikes. You're probably going to say Ribble anyway to go and buy. But how do people, if they're going to target a race and get into the sport, what do they need? Is it electronic gearing and, you know, the most expensive race is going to give you the best time? Or should you be a bit more selective with what you're doing? And yeah, what would be your advice?
So my biggest piece of advice would probably be, I would advise not to start with a UCI race just because they're quite intense and a bit road racy. I would say pick a gravel race somewhere you're really excited to go and travel. So whether that's the Rift in Iceland or the Tracker in Girona, if anyone said pick one race that someone wanting to start out with gravel should do, I would say pick a distance of the Tracker that sounds like a challenge to you. There's like the 50K, the 100, the 200, the 360, the 560. There is a distance for absolutely everyone. And like, in terms of the actual quality of the gravel here, it's incredible. So like, it's probably the best place to do gravel. I do think the Tracker for this year though has sold out for all the distances, but something for 2025. But yeah, I love electronic gears personally. I wouldn't say that's an essential. I'd think about tire choice. I'd think about comfort. I'd think about snacks. That's really important with gravel racing, especially when you're racing all day. Like, what can you eat and keep eating for hours? Because actually, realistically, you can't eat gels for 16 hours. I've tried it. I've thrown up a lot. It doesn't work.
All right.
But yeah, I think just things like that. It's all about, if you're doing gravel for the sake of like wanting to challenge yourself and enjoyment, like it's all about comfort and how to have a good time. And a lot of these races have proper food stops, and with good atmosphere at the food stops as well. So like stopping if you need to stop. But yeah, I'd say it's just about having a good time really, and just like making sure you get the volume of miles in your legs before you do an event that's ridiculously long, because you don't want to get halfway around and not be able to finish it.
Yeah, the training is key, right?
Yeah, I think a lot,
especially
of
if you're going to be one. Yeah. Good. Well, Maddie, I've taken up enough of your day, and thank you so much for coming on and sharing what you have. If you're over in Drona in June, July time, we'll have to catch up and you can show me some of the gravel scene over there.
Definitely. It's honestly the best place that I've ever gravel ridden. It's so good.
Ever graveled?
I've ever
graveled. YouTube channel, just YouTube/MaddieNutt. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just my name. I didn't get creative with the YouTube name.
No, makes sense. Your name. And Instagram also, Maddie_Nutt.
It's actually
well. Maddie_Nutt
Nutty, because I have a Maddie_Nutt account. That was my first ever Instagram account, but that was like me at school and at uni, and it's nothing to do with cycling. And then I made the cycling account as a separate account, and now they're... I don't even use the other account, but I took that name, so the handle was taken. So it's Maddie Nutty, and sometimes people think that's my last name, and they're like, "Hey, Maddie Nutty,
go with it.
That's not my name."
Go with it. With the grey hairs, it makes sense. So stick with it. I think good for branding.
Yeah, I should maybe make my Instagram Nutty.
Brilliant. And just so we know, this year, what races are you heading to? In case we've got any listeners going to the same races, they can come over and call you Maddie Nutty.
No, this is a good question. Okay, I've got the list. So they're the key ones. I mean, the race list for 2024 is pretty long. So UK, Battle on the Beach, Dirty Reaver. Then Tracker 360. I'm going to try and do better than I did last year. That's one of my big focuses. The Gralic in Scotland, Unbound in America. And then I'm going to Kenya. I'm doing Safari Gravel, Migration Gravel. Then I'm going to Mexico for Gravel Mexico again. Then I'm going to Iceland for the Rift, Steamboat in Colorado. Badlands is nearly 800 kilometers and I might die. And then I might be going over to Finland. And then the end of my season is kind of anything after Badlands. I've put a question mark on because I'm not sure how I'm going to be. But maybe World Champs and most likely the Graveler final. And that's October, that's off season.
Unreal. Well, you're going to see three of our guys in Kenya.
Oh, cool.
You'll meet Marcus over there and a couple of others, I believe. So awesome. That'll be good.
Yeah, it's honestly, that was one of the absolute highlights of my year last year, that race.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
I can imagine. Excellent. Badlands will be different level. Maybe we get you back on the show after Badlands and hear all about it.
If I make it round. If I don't, maybe I could talk about how I didn't make it round.
Yeah, we can do that if you want. We can talk about your transition into unicycling.
When I have a cycling career.
I'll have to have Rob Jones on the show for that, the co-host, because he'll love to hear about that. And Josh, maybe. Good. Maddie, thank you so much. Guys, go check out Maddie's videos, social pages, and if you're going to any of those races on the list, then obviously go over and say hello. She'll shove a camera in your face and you'll get to be on her YouTube channel. Perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. Maddie, thanks a lot.
Cheers. Cheers. Shall I stop the recording?
Where's
How do I end the recording? Oh, stop recording.